Greetings, and welcome to CatastropheCast.com. My name is Walter, and today we're going to tackle the biggest airline catastrophe in aviation history, and that would be the Tenerife Airport catastrophe that happened March 27th, 1977. The reason it goes down as the deadliest airplane accident in aviation history is this plane actually, or rather these planes, when they crashed, took 583 souls. That is the largest. I know that there was a JAL crash of a 747 back in the 1980s, I believe, that took about 520 souls, but this does remain as the deadliest airplane accident in aviation history. If you listen to the introductory podcast of CatastropheCast.com, you heard me talk about, well, me being such a geek that, you know, at the age of 5-6 years old, I wanted to be an NTSB air crash investigator. So, as an example of that, I can say that this particular podcast, when I decided to do it, I practically did not need any notes. I've been, you know, reading up on this catastrophe for years, you know, ever since it happened, so I know quite a bit about it. So let's get into it. I'm going to give you a little bit of a background first. The first flight that was involved was a KLM Boeing 747. It was flight 4805, and it was a charter flight for a vacation company that was flying from Amsterdam to the Canary Islands. It was to land at Las Palmas in the Canary Islands. There were 235 passengers and 14 crew on the plane. The second plane that was involved was Pan Am Flight 1736. Now, that flight had originated in L.A., and it had flown from L.A. to New York City, landing at JFK. In JFK, there were a few passengers that got on, a few passengers that got off, and the crew was switched out. So when it took off from JFK, bound for Las Palmas in the Canary Islands, there were 380 passengers and 16 crew. So, first plane had almost 250 passengers. Second plane had almost 400 passengers. So, right there, you know this is big. One curiosity about the Pan Am 747, it was a 747-100. I believe the variant was 136. This plane was called the Clipper Victor. And the Clipper Victor actually had inaugurated 747 service, not just for Pan Am, but for the world. It was the first 747 to go into commercial service. So that right there shows you the history of this plane. It had been inaugurated in 1970, I believe. So it was not even a decade old when this crash happened. So you've got the KLM flight and the Pan Am flight both headed to Las Palmas for a vacation for all their passengers and some of their crew in the sun. It was supposed to be, you know, a good time. Now, we're going to go into the different parts of this that contributed to the catastrophe. And going through the evidence, I count about 8 things that went wrong. So without any one of these 8 things, this wouldn't have happened. The catastrophe would not have happened at all. It's just that chilling. So the first thing to go wrong was there was a bombing that happened at Las Palmas. On the Canary Islands, there was political unrest. And a political separatist group, which was called, and I'm going to apologize now if I massacre the pronunciation here, Fuerzas Armadas Guanaches. That political separatist group planted a bomb at Las Palmas Airport, which was where both planes, actually where a lot of planes were destined. They planted a bomb there, then called it a bomb threat. The airport ended up being evacuated because you've got a bomb threat. just like we had in San Antonio a couple of days ago, you're going to evacuate the public. And actually, most bomb threats are, you know, they're not, they may be credible, but there's no bomb. In this case, there actually was a bomb. A bomb went off at 1:15 local time in the afternoon. A caller called back and said that there was actually a second bomb at the airport. At this point, you can imagine Las Palmas Airport being in such chaos that, you know, they had a bomb threat. They tried to get everybody out. The first bomb actually did go off and killed someone. So you can imagine, you know, this was not a good place to be. So what are they going to do? They're going to divert all these other, all these airplanes that are overhead, going to divert them over to Los Rodeos Airport. Los Rodeos Airport is a much smaller airport. It's not used to that much traffic, you know, at the time. So you've got all these planes all of a sudden not allowed to land at Las Palmas. They're all forced to go to Los Rodeos. So the second thing in this link of eight things to go wrong, the KLM pilot, Jacob Van Zanten, who was one of the most senior pilots at KLM. He was the one who taught most of the other pilots the 747 and certified them so that they could fly it. As a matter of fact, he certified the co-pilot for this crew about 2 months beforehand. The KLM pilot did not want to divert to Los Rodeos. He said, let's just stay up in the air and we'll circle until the airport is opened. But because of what was going on at Las Palmas, the air traffic control at Las Palmas said, no, you're going to have to go and land over at Los Rodeos. The request was denied. So that's the second bit that was bad. Okay, so now we come to the third thing to go wrong. So, as I said, there were a ton of planes that landed at Los Rodeos because Las Palmas had closed. So we've got all these planes that are there at Los Rodeos. The airport was absolutely packed, and air traffic control, nobody in Los Rodeos was used to this many planes. You couldn't safely move about the airport. The planes just couldn't safely move without, you know, hitting another airplane. So when they finally actually declared that the airport at Las Palmas was open, Pan Am Flight 1736 was ready to go. They're like, we're here, we're ready, let's go. But the thing is, they were blocked by the KLM plane. The co-pilots actually got out, walked around the plane, and measured, and they lacked about 12 feet to be able to go around the KLM flight. And the reason that the KLM flight was there blocking them was that the KLM captain, Captain Van Zanten, decided once he got to Las Palmas, he didn't want any additional delays. He wanted to go ahead, get his gas in Los Rodeos instead of, you know, going to Las Palmas and then letting everybody off the plane, then refueling, then putting everybody back on the plane and, you know, the next set of passengers back on the plane to go home. So this I actually count as the fourth thing to go wrong, because if he had not chosen to put that, you know, 60 tons of fuel on his plane, that would have allowed the Pan Am flight to go ahead, take off, and be on their way. But because of where the KLM 747 was parked and where the Pan Am flight was parked, it meant that the Pan Am flight was going to have to take off second. So, like I said, that's the fourth thing to go wrong. So, all right, airport in Las Palmas is open. Cool. The KLM flight finally has taken on their 60 tons of fuel. Cool. The KLM flight starts to taxi down the runway, and the Pan Am flight is behind them. So what's going to happen? It's a small airport. I think I'll try and put up a diagram on catastrophecast.com so you could actually see the diagram of the airport. To me, honestly, it looks like a small municipal airport. It does not look like anything that would be able to handle international travel. So you've got these flights, these 747s that are taxing. The 747, the KLM 747 was to taxi out, taxi all the way down the runway, do a 180, wait for the Pan Am flight to taxi behind them, then divert off at one of the turns, and then wait for this, you know, the KLM flight. Once it had a clear runway, the KLM flight would take off, and then the Pan Am flight would take off. But they didn't. What happened was the fifth thing to go wrong, and that was the weather. So as the KLM and Pan Am flights start to taxi down the runways, the weather just abruptly changed. It just really deteriorated, and fog just rolled in off the hills around Los Rodeos Airport. So there's a guideline that you need about 2,300 feet, I believe it's 700 meters, to be able to take off in a 747. And they didn't have it at the time. They had, at one point, I believe it was about 1,000 feet clearance. So they actually had to wait quite a bit. So, you know, you can imagine, you know, all right, first this one airport is closed, and then we have to divert, and now we're waiting for this and that and the other. And, you know, as a person who travels, I can actually say delays, yeah, they're annoying. So now you've got the fog that's rolling in. So that's going to be another thing, you know, just to go wrong. You couldn't see the end of the runway. It was, you know, it had to have been frustrating. So you've got the KLM flight. They taxied out to the end of the runway to do a 180. The Pan Am was behind them to go off. Now, here's the sixth thing to go wrong. Like I said before, the Los Rodeos Airport was a small, sleepy airport. They were not used to this many flights at one time, much less, you know, they had probably seen more flights in a day than they had seen in a month beforehand. So the controllers just were not used to this. And one thing that came out when you combined the cockpit voice recorders from the two 747s and the tower was the controllers, there were two of them, were actually listening to a football match at the time. And this is, of course, European football, not American football. So what Americans call soccer. So it's almost like the controllers, you know, they were in their old habits of being able to multitask, of, you know, listening to a football game while there's a few, you know, a two or three small aircraft around. Well, they stayed in that habit, even though they were packed to the gills with aircraft and they had 747s around them. So they're still listening to this football match. When they're talking to the Pan Am flight, they said, go ahead and exit at the third taxiway. Now, at the time where they were on the taxiway, the Pan Am flight engineer basically said, you know, oh, wait a minute. We've passed one. Do you want us to go to the fourth? So are we going to the third from where we're at, or do you mean the third? And the air traffic basically did not give them a proper answer. So the other little bit of information about the third taxiway is back in 1979, and actually it's probably still this way today, the taxiway itself is at a really odd angle. So it wasn't easy to see. And back in 1979, it wasn't marked that well. So if you're not used to seeing, if you're used to seeing something, you know, as you're going down a runway and you're used to seeing something branch off easily, yeah, you're going to be able to see that. So branching off going to your right. But if it's kind of branching off behind you as you are approaching it, you're not going to be able to see it that well. So that was the the sixth thing to go wrong. You know, the ATC in their clumsy communication system and the way that the airport was actually visually done. So you've got this confusion going on in the Pan Am cockpit. Okay, so we're getting close to the accident here. And this is where the seventh thing to go wrong comes into play. And that would be simultaneous radio transmission. So the air traffic controller contacted the KLM flight. And they were giving them instructions. However, because of where the Pan Am flight broke in, part of the instructions were not heard. Because back then, when you had two people talking on the same frequency at a time, it basically caused like a communication blackout. You know, we've changed it today to where there's a squelch, so that if you've got two people who are talking at the same time, you'll hear the squelch, so you know it didn't happen. But that wasn't the way that it worked at the time. So air traffic control contacted the KLM flight. The Pan Am people broke in, saying that they were still on the runway, but that because they were transmitting at the same time, the KLM flight never actually heard that, nor did they hear what was coming from the ATC. So that right there, I mean, that is a huge warning. That's a huge mistake. There's not much that could be done with it at the time, but it actually leads us into the eighth and final thing to go wrong. And this is probably the biggest problem with the entire catastrophe. And that was, as I said before, the KLM pilot, Van Santen, he was one of the most senior people at KLM. He taught these people. They should respect him. In a way, this made him really impatient and pushy. So back in the 1970s, there was more of a hierarchy to the cockpit. So you've got the most senior pilot, and then you've got this other guy who's a co-pilot who's not as senior, probably. And then you've got a flight engineer if you were on a 747 or a plane that needed a flight engineer. And they're probably even more junior. I can't really explain it that well other than to say in the way that you would have to respect those people above you. And nobody would question at the time, nobody would question the authority of someone above them. Well, that's exactly what happened with Pilot Van Santen. He actually started to take off once without clearance at all. And an unheard of thing happened. His first officer actually stood up to him. You know, it was really unheard of at the time. You didn't talk to, you know, you didn't question your boss, much less one of the most senior pilots from your airline. You just didn't do it. So the pilot backed off for a few minutes. The air traffic control gave them clearance, the taxi clearance and permission to fly, the instructions that they were needed. You know, you take off, you do the, you know, you fly to this beacon, report in, yada, yada, yada. But the thing is, that was the clearance to fly. That wasn't actually takeoff clearance. That is something that you have to get separately. But what happened was, you know, for whatever was going on in Van Zanten's mind, being impatient and pushy and knowing more than anybody else on the ground, you know, that was probably what was in his mind, he decided, you know what, I don't care, we're taking off. So he's starting his roll down the runway. The Pan Am flight actually is like, you know, we're still taxiing, but because of how the radio interference worked, the KLM flight actually didn't hear that the Pan Am was still taxiing. So you've got this KLM flight that's just barreling down the runway, and the air traffic control didn't know about it because they couldn't see them. Neither could the Pan Am flight. The Pan Am people said, okay, we're going to report when we're off the runway so you can give clearance for KLM to take off. But, you know, like I said, KLM, Captain Van Zanten was doing his own thing. In less than 20 seconds after Van Zanten decided to start taking off, the KLM flight saw the Pan Am flight and vice versa. And the KLM pilot, you know, thrust the gear to as fast as it could go, the engines as fast as it could go, and, you know, pulled up so that the tail of the 747 actually dragged down the length of the runway until they got basically just about to where the Pan Am flight was. And the Pan Am flight actually saw them. It only took, you know, it was about 20 seconds after he took off is when he actually saw the Pan Am flight. And within 10 seconds, you know, he did not have enough time to do anything. He tried all his might, but he had no chance. And he got airborne just a little bit. But what happened was the part of his fuselage and his landing gear just tore right through the 747 from Pan Am. Just tore right through it. I remember seeing something where one of the pilots from Pan Am said the upper deck was gone. The first class section was just gone. There was nothing there. And that's because this KLM flight came through and just ripped it off. So you've got this KLM flight who is just, you know, was barely airborne. You know, they struggle, they hit this plane, and once they hit it, you know, they're going to lose everything. So they basically tumble towards the end of the runway, and that plane crashes, and nobody survives. Everybody on that plane perishes. So, like I said, that one lucky person who said, hey, my boyfriend's here, I'm going to go surprise him, she was the only person to make it off because she never got back on that plane. On the Pan Am flight, most of the people did die. There were 326 passengers and 9 crew that died. One curious thing that I found in the investigation of this was, okay, so you've just been hit. What do? So you try and shut down things as quickly as possible because you don't want a running engine to, you know, be there and injure somebody. You don't want this engine, you know, running. So the flight engineer went ahead and cut the engines on the Pan Am flight. But because of where the KLM flight hit the Pan Am flight, the Pan Am 747, actually the lines that took the instructions from the cockpit to the engines were severed. So the engines actually were still at full thrust because, you know, that captain, when he saw the 747 coming at him, the KLM 747 coming at him, he put it in full thrust to get off of the runway as quickly as he could. Now, as I said, 326 passengers and 9 crew died. I really couldn't tell if it was 8 initially and then 1 afterward, or if there was 9 initially and then an additional one did die. And what happened, the reason I bring that up is these engines were still going at full bore. They were just going as fast as they can. When they finally started to disintegrate because of the high rev that they were in for so long, one of the engines, you know, the engines disintegrated, and one of the engines threw a whole bunch of debris, which killed a flight attendant. I mean, can you imagine? You're a flight attendant, you've just been in a horrific crash, and what happens? Okay, I've got to get out. I got to get my passengers out safely. You get them out safely, and you survive this crash, and you're sitting there just, you know, thanking whoever is out there looking for you to keep you from dying in this horrific crash. And, you know, you're probably coming off the adrenaline of all this, and boom, an engine blows up and kills you. I mean, that, I think, I have to say, that's probably one of the most heartbreaking things. That's one of the things that I actually learned in doing additional investigation into this catastrophe. And it's got to be one of the most heartbreaking things. You just can't even fathom that. So, all in all, like I said, every soul on the KLM flight was lost. And only 56 passengers and 5 crew survived from the Pan Am flight. Here's another little wrinkle. The weather, like I said, that was what, the fifth thing to go wrong? The weather was so bad that the fire engines started to, you know, they started to roll. And they came across the KLM plane and they tried to save people. Of course, they couldn't. There was nobody that actually survived that crash. But they were so focused on it, they actually had no idea there was another plane that was involved. They absolutely had no idea until people started walking up to them saying, there's another plane back there. There's people back there that are hurt. You need to come help us too. That, I mean, that is, that itself is also just heart-wrenching to think about that. You've been in this accident and nobody even knows. So, I mean, you've got this horrific accident. You've got this horrible, you know, probably one of the worst outcomes, people not even knowing that you need help. And you've got 56 passengers, 5 crew who actually managed to survive and get out. I mean, that in itself, when you look at this, when you look at some of the accident photos, it's just miraculous that anybody survived out of this, what, almost 650 people. So there are always good things that come out of bad situations. I will say that. And there are 3 particular bits that show the good that comes out of this. The first thing is the atmosphere in the cockpit changed. Like I said before, you would never, I mean, if you were a junior pilot, you would never challenge somebody with, you know, 30 years experience, your senior. You never would. So the cockpits had that hierarchy of, you will do what I say. After the accident, and after months and months of investigations and going into it, there was new training that went out. And that new training basically was that anyone who's in the cockpit, from the most junior person to the most senior person, they're all considered equals. Anybody in the cockpit is allowed to challenge anything that's going on. So if that type of situation had been in effect when Tenerife happened, Tenerife probably wouldn't have happened. The second thing is that there was a greater emphasis that was put on standardizing communications between air traffic control and pilots, and then of course pilots between other planes. So at the time you could just acknowledge with an okay or a roger if you got some sort of, you know, air traffic control instructions. What happens now is, and I'm gonna, you know, do a little stage acting here. So air traffic control will come up and say something like, Clipper 456, taxi to runway 28 and hold. And instead of saying roger or okay, the Pan Am pilot now would respond, Clipper 456, taxi runway 28 and hold, roger. So that greater emphasis on standardized communication is helping so that people understand what is actually going on. Your air traffic control talks to you. You repeat back to the air traffic controller so that everybody knows and everybody understands that they're all on the same page. There's another little twist to this, and that is that at the time, not all communication was done in English. So there's been a very, very, there was a push to basically have people start talking in English more for standardized communication. So it's much, much easier. And the third thing to come out of this, and this is probably one of the most important, actually they're all three really important, but the airport markings, there basically was a new standard for airport markings. So remember when when Pan Am was saying, wait a minute, you said third, do you mean the third from where we are? Or do you mean, you know, the 1, 2, 3, the third? So they were confused. And like I said, the third exit was at this really, really odd angle. Wasn't really well marked. So what happened As a result of this is that airport markings of all taxiways, they're now much more clear and much more concise, so that there is no question where, you know, where exit 3 is and which one you should take. So those are the three good things to come out of this horrific, horrific catastrophe. So in a nutshell, that is the Tenerife airport catastrophe of 1977, the loss of 2 747s and 583 people. I want to thank you for listening, and want to say, please don't hesitate to come on over to catastrophecast.com. I'm planning on doing more articles. I want to try and do a couple of articles a week so that people can catch up on things. You can subscribe to the catastrophecast.com website by putting in your email address and letting us know, you know, we'll let you know when there's a new post out. And then in return, there's a contact form that you can contact us if you have questions about catastrophecast.com, or if there's something you want to see us cover. There's also our email address, which you can email us any ideas or feedback, and that would be podcast@catastrophecast.com. Thank you for listening.